On behalf of IronNet Cybersecurity, AWS, and Carahsoft, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focused around collective defense and the global cyber threat environment, where Major General Brett Williams, co-founder and chief operating officer at IronNet, and Eli Kahn, principal product manager of AWS Security Hub at AWS, will discuss how a collective defense strategy can allow federal agencies to better detect, share, and correlate behaviors across the public and private sectors to help prevent attacks.
Today, I'm honored to be hosting a conversation between Brett Williams and Eli Kahn. Major Brett Williams has had a long and storied career in the U.S. federal government and military, serving for 33 years with the U.S. Air Force. He finished his career as Director of Operations at U.S. Cyber Command, where he was the architect of DoD's operational approach to cyberspace operations. He was responsible for the operations and defense of DoD networks, as well as offensive operations in support of U.S. objectives. Prior to serving as Director of Operations for U.S. Cyber Command, General Williams also served as Director of Operations of the Pentagon, leading over 1,300 airmen and civilian stations worldwide, as well as Director of Communications, Command and Control for U.S. PACOM. He's a highly experienced combat fighter pilot. We're honored to have Major General Williams here with us. We're also honored to have with us Eli Kahn, who today serves as the principal product manager at AWS. But Eli also has likewise a storied career both in the government and the private sector, having served at the Transportation Security Administration during the Bush administration, as well as deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security in the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, as director of cybersecurity at the National Security Council at the White House, a co-founder of Squirrel, eventually acquired by Amazon, and a seed investor in a number of companies. So, thank you to Major General Williams and Eli for being here with us. And we'll just jump right into the conversation. I want to start with you, Major General Williams, if I could. And, you know, we're talking about the global threat environment today. And many have argued that the environment today, particularly in the cyber arena, is becoming more dangerous in the what we hope to soon be the post-COVID environment. What do you see as the major global threats at this time, in particular, focused on these cyber-enabled threats?
Yeah, thanks, Jamil, and thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate everyone dialing in to hear our discussion today, and we look forward to your questions and participation as we go along. It's interesting. I think that over the last 3 or 4 years, that the idea of a nation state threat has really come to the forefront. You know, as I gave keynotes and talked to boards, 4 or 5 years ago, it was rare I brought up nation state threats. I think the 2016 election, though, really highlighted that. You know, cyberspace is a place of great benefit and advantage, but there's also a ton of threats out there. And so as we look across nation state threats and sophisticated criminal threats, you know, all of these have the opportunity to have an impact on our business every day. Because, you know, as much as, you know, my previous command at Cyber Command felt like it was our job to defend the nation in cyberspace, the fact is the private sector is on the front lines of this fight. And so how we support and how we make sure that our nation's critical infrastructure defended are really important. You know, at the top level, Jamil, I think that we would agree that we still have concerns with Russia and China, Iran and North Korea. Each of those, you know, slightly different context. You know, just quickly, my thought is, China remains focused on intellectual property. They've focused on R&D. They focus on ways to advance their internal strategic goals by, frankly, getting some information from other places. And we see that in our education system. We see that in the commercial system. We see that in the defense industrial base. And we've got to continue to keep an eye on that. Russia, disinformation, right? They were doing that long before the internet came along. The internet's made them capable of doing that at scale. It's carried through the election. And articles I read today identifying Russian disinformation around COVID. So I would argue twofold on Russia. This idea of, can I create internal divisions and dissension within the United States? And frankly, right now, we don't need much help with that. But anything they can do to help us stay internally focused is an advantage to Russia's strategic goals. And then threats to critical infrastructure. I don't need to talk probably much to this group about what we've seen them do in the energy sector, what we've seen them do in a number of countries around critical infrastructure. Iran remains a concern because they are the ones that have demonstrated willingness to do destructive attacks. Going back to attacks on our financial system in 2012 and 13, numerous examples in the Middle East, particularly in Saudi Arabia with Aramco and others. Iran, while smaller in capability, the challenge is they've demonstrated it because it's a very useful asymmetric tool, if you will. They can't compete in physical space, but they can certainly create some significant challenges in virtual space. And then North Korea remains, frankly, after the money. They're trying to get away from the sanctions and to be able to take advantage of that. And so when you wrap all of that up, I think that there are people that listen to this and go, okay, well, that won't affect my business, all right? I would challenge you to find a business that would not be somewhere in one of those value chains that I just described. And so I think everybody has to consider the fact they could be there. And then the second thing is even if you aren't the target of a nation state threat, the capabilities, the expertise that we saw from Cyber Command only in nation states are now widely available, the dark web, et cetera. And so you have to be prepared to defend against threats at that level. And so that's kind of my one over the world on where I see the cyberspace challenges today and how we work all together to defend against those is, I think, a critical approach.
Yeah, and I want to stick with you for a minute before we go to Eli and talk about cloud. I'm interested to know, so you mentioned, sort of this, the spread of capabilities and the potential for nation state threats to be used by other actors. There's also the problem, isn't there, of collateral damage, right? As we saw in the NotPetya attacks. Tell us about how collateral damage might affect, you know, companies that otherwise might, or government agencies, frankly, that might not otherwise generally be targeted by these high-end nation-state attackers.
Absolutely, Jamil. Yeah, and NotPetya and some of those other ransomware attacks a couple of years ago are a good example of exactly what you're talking about. To this day, we don't know who was the specific target of those attacks, right? But they either spread unintentionally from the person that started it, right? They don't realize, you know, what are the cascading effects of what they do. Or other people pick those tools up, or they may even get them through some of the exposure of government capabilities. And as a result, they can proliferate very quickly. So it just reinforces the point that I think regardless of where you are, you have to be concerned with needing to face a very sophisticated threat.
And talk to us about the impact on supply chains. What is the effect of these kind of threats and these kind of actors on supply chains? Are they just focused on the high end, the sort of the large contractor, or are they folks through the entire supply chain?
Yeah, my example for that has always been, if we go back kind of the late 2000s, there were several pretty well publicized breaches and attacks against some of our larger defense contractors, right? And they have the money to put into these defenses. They've made themselves very secure. And so what we've seen over the last several years is a number of attacks that have been successful against people in that supply chain because they can't defend themselves as well, yet they are connected to that entity that has the intellectual property or has whatever information that the attacker wants. And so, you know, being able to have visibility over that supply chain or that value chain, whether you're a defense contractor and all those suppliers, or you're an energy company, understanding that somebody supplies a critical sensor to make my nuclear power plant work, how well are they defending that architecture, those schematics, et cetera, that they need to have in order to supply that? And then go to the financial sector, right? That take a credit card company or a large investment bank. They've got a ton of partners, suppliers, customers that are part of their supply chain. And again, that's where the attacks are more likely to come in those less capable organizations that fundamentally have the same access as that larger core organization.
Yeah, yeah. So, Major Generals, I want to stick with you for a little bit longer. And Eli, I do want to talk to you about how this plays out in the cloud environment, because obviously that's key to part of the conversation we want to have today. So, you know, Major Generals, you mentioned that we're in this tense environment with the COVID virus. We also saw the Justice Department just last week indict two Chinese hackers who were engaged in extensive IP theft across a range of industries. We saw them focused in part on COVID-19. We saw them operating across aerospace, defense, commercial software. What is the connection between Chinese criminal hackers on one side and Chinese government hackers on the other? Are they working together? How does this work in China?
You know, absolutely, there is a connection there. I would argue that we don't understand exactly what those connections are. And frankly, they're more obfuscated in Russia, but we know they exist. I think it's interesting to note the first time that we indicted Chinese hackers at the end of the Obama administration, there was some excitement in the air because, oh, they seem to have gotten a lot quieter, right? And, because what we'd always seen from the Chinese before was kind of that jewelry gang that would smash the cases, you know, blow out the door, take as much as they can. And then whoever, whatever they got away with. And if somebody got caught, you know, that was fine. The point was they got what they wanted. Well, what I would argue those indictments were maybe a catalyst for the Chinese to look at how they operate, for them to get quieter, for them to get more sophisticated about how they integrate, if you will, those government sector and private sector activities. And frankly, what we see with a number of the indictments is we're indicting people that are doing essentially commercial hacking that work for the People's Liberation Army. Frankly, it's a different model in China. There's not that same diversification between government efforts and private sector efforts. And in some other countries, we see people who just moonlight, right? They're doing work on the side that leverages the skills they've gotten, as a nation state operative. And so it makes for a very complex environment, but I think it all boils down to almost everyone has the potential to face a fairly sophisticated actor.
Yeah. You know, and we've seen heightened tensions now, you know, with obviously COVID, what's going on in Hong Kong. We've got the recent consulate closures. So there's tension with China. But at the same time, we're approaching elections here in the United States. And we know about the Russian cyber activities during the 2016 elections. How concerned should we be both about the government customer, but also the commercial customer when it comes to this current environment that we're in as we move towards the elections in 2020 in November?
My view is that our biggest concern with the elections really remains what it was in 2016. While we have some concerns over the actual mechanics of the election being messed with, if I'm a Russian actor or even a Chinese actor that wanted to influence it, man, I'm going to go full in on social media disinformation, and I'm going to leverage all that internet stuff to get my message out. Because frankly, I think that they can get a lot closer to their goals that way. You know, that said, you know, I think the role of all of us is to be aware of that, to be conscious of whether we're a company or a private individual, what kind of information we share, and just be aware that, you know, we're all subject to that type of manipulation. And to me, that's the biggest threat the election poses. And, you know, as far as the COVID piece of this, you know, it's driving different social dynamics. It's driving a lot of changes to how we interact and how we both do business in our personal life. And our adversaries are very conscious and aware of that, and they are going to continue to try to leverage that to their goals.
Yeah. And given the threat environment you just described, how should government contractors and agencies be thinking about securing their systems, particularly as they move to this cloud environment?
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, you know, another thing we saw out of the Chinese was, you know, about that same time, 2015, we saw what was called the Cloud Hopper campaign come out. You know, it's kind of Willie Sutton kind of thing. We go to the banks because that's where the money is. Well, the hackers figured out that if everybody's going to the cloud, and if I can get to the cloud service providers, or I can get to other places where I can take advantage of getting at 1,000 targets instead of just one target by cracking a cloud environment, then clearly that's a threat. You know, the most recent IBM security study also highlighted that, you know, that the cloud is an area of great focus for hackers and actors. And I'm sure Eli will talk about this, but one of the things I've certainly learned is the cloud is more securable. For instance, AWS builds more than enough security capability in there. It comes to how do you configure it as a user and how do you protect credentials and those sorts of things. And so I'd be interested to hear Eli maybe touch on more of that. But I think the biggest point I would make, Jamil, is the cloud is not a panacea. It's not a solution to security. It's still about how do you employ the basic tenets of security around identity access management, encryption, all of those sorts of things.
Well, Eli, let's talk about that. So why is the, you know, General Williams just laid out the idea that cloud security is better, perhaps easier. Why is it better than this classic on-prem model? What is it? What do you do differently in a cloud environment that makes it different or perhaps easier?
Yeah. Maybe before I jump into that, just one point of clarification on the Cloud Hopper threats and investigation. That actually was not targeting cloud service providers like AWS. It was actually targeting managed security or managed service providers. So if you had a managed service provider that was providing all of your IT infrastructure, they're actually targeting the infrastructure that those MSPs use to manage their various customers. So the Cloud Hopper threat might be a little bit misnamed. It was really hopping between managed service provider customers, not the actual cloud service providers. Just an important clarification there. But to go back to your question, why is it easier to secure your infrastructure in the cloud than, you know, perhaps on-prem? I think about that in really three different ways. First, really our scale. So the scale of AWS allows us to invest more in security, both in terms of our security technology, processes, and people, more so than a typical organization. In fact, more so than probably the vast, vast majority of organizations. We're doing some really incredible things in terms of making sure all of that underlying infrastructure that the cloud is running on is properly patched. Any vulnerabilities are squeezed out of the system, you know, running some very advanced threat detections to make sure that, you know, the actual, you know, control plane of the cloud is secure. So our scale lets us to invest in security in a massive way. You know, for us, AWS security is really job one. If AWS wasn't secure, folks wouldn't use it. So it's a priority that goes all the way up to the CEO as a key initiative. Secondly, in terms of advantages from a security perspective for cloud, it's really the simplicity of running security solutions in the cloud. So this was a big change. You know, I came from the startup world. Ultimately, you know, our startup was acquired by AWS, security threat hunting startup called Squirrel. And with Squirrel, it actually oftentimes take customers a month to get up and running with our software. And that was pretty typical, I think, for the larger security industry. Once we came into AWS, it's a totally different paradigm in that all of our security solutions are designed to be one click or close to one click in terms of getting up and running. So with the product I'm currently running, Security Hub, you can go into the management console of AWS and with literally one click, start up Security Hub and you'll start getting results about your configuration issues, about any alerts that you might have from our other AWS security services. And then the third piece is really around visibility. The adage goes, you can't secure what you don't know about. And asset management is sort of like the, you know, a cornerstone to doing good security. And it's oftentimes an afterthought. Usually the folks that are doing asset management aren't even connected to or part of the security team, which makes securing those assets difficult. You know, with AWS, everything is an API call away. And by that, I mean, you can do a describe API call to understand every single resource that's deployed in your AWS accounts. And we actually even have services like AWS Config and System Manager that make that even easier, that continuously collect your asset or resource inventory. So having understanding of everything that's deployed in your accounts with a, you know, click of a button really helps eliminate the notion of shadow IT, which is, you know, I think a problem that most folks are familiar with, figuring out how to secure those shadow resources really isn't a problem that you would see in AWS.
And what about this? What about this idea of scale, right? So you know, a lot of people have talked about in the cloud environment, you know, if I want to deploy a patch or solve for a problem, I can just hit a button and it deploys all my systems instantaneously. If I've got a problem with the system, I can spin it down and spin up a new instance. I mean, does that help with security also?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we talk about deploying patches, maybe there's a nuance there. So There's something inside or something associated with AWS called the shared responsibility model, which is AWS owns the security for everything below the hypervisor. So the hypervisor itself, which is that infrastructure used to provision cloud resources on top of the actual physical hardware. So the physical hardware, the hypervisor, AWS owns the security. The customer doesn't have to worry about that. So we take care of all the patching and vulnerability management of that underlying physical infrastructure. Right. And then, you know, the customer is responsible for making sure that the actual software that they're running in that virtualized state is patched. But, you know, the shared responsibility model doesn't mean that, you know, AWS sort of just wipes its hand clean and says, customer, go figure it out. You know, we try to make that as simple as possible for a customer to do. And, you know, like you said, Jamil, it's oftentimes one click to deploy that across an entire fleet of virtual servers or EC2 instances, you know, a much easier process than trying to, you know, track down physical servers to patch them.
Yeah. How's AWS innovating in the security arena? Obviously, we know they're innovating by buying companies like Squirrel. what else is AWS doing to innovate in this space? You said you're running a product called Security Hub. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Security Hub, is in the spirit of one-click security. It's designed to make it stupidly simple to quickly understand your security posture in AWS. So we're doing automated security hygiene checks across all of your deployed AWS services and resources. And we're also aggregating, correlating, and normalizing various security alerts that you're generating, not only from your AWS services like Guard, Duty Inspector, Macy, but also partner products. So bring that all into Security Hub so that folks can not only understand their security posture, but take action on it. So we're doing some interesting things there in Security Hub. You know, in general, though, I think some of the more exciting areas of innovation around AWS security services is what we're doing around machine learning. So we have other services like GuardDuty, which is a threat detection service that's using a variety of machine learning models to automatically detect threats, you know, unusual type behaviors, also behaviors aligned to known attack patterns or threat tactics, and using unsupervised machine learning to detect those threats. We're also doing some really cool stuff that, frankly, I hadn't heard about until I came to AWS. You know, machine learning gets a lot of hype. There's also a different area of math that goes into some really complex stuff called solvability module theorems. Think about like back in high school math and geometry when you're building out proofs. Well, we have groups of folks that are part of our automated reasoning group that build automated proofs to help assess your security. So for example, if you have an EC2 instance inside a virtual private network in AWS, is that EC2 instance reachable to the internet? You know, or is it secure in that it's, you know, behind network access controls and behind security groups? That's actually a complicated problem because there's a lot of different factors there that could make something accessible to the internet. And so we're running these mathematical proofs to automatically prove whether that resource is accessible to the internet. We're doing similar things around identity access management policies, using mathematical proofs to prove that this identity access management policy is more or less permissive than this other one, whether it's too permissive based on AWS security best practices.
Interesting. That's pretty cool. So, you know, beyond these sort of core security practices and solutions that you all offer to your customers, you also partner with outside vendors like IronNet, through people like Carahsoft. What is the role of these partners in delivering cybersecurity solutions in both cloud and hybrid environments for your customers?
So AWS's partner network is probably one of our biggest strengths as a cloud service provider. Just in the security and identity space, we have 1,600 partners in the Amazon Partner Network. So, you know, our real goal with building that strong partner network is, one, giving customers choice. You know, we want to really provide customers with the ability to pick the security solution that they are comfortable with. Maybe it's one that they've already used that they now want to use in AWS. Maybe it's just the one that they think is best of breed. But we also realize that, you know, AWS security services aren't going to cover the full gamut of every type of security product. You know, there are some things that we can do really well because we're really close to the data and we can move that data, analyze that data more effectively and efficiently than perhaps a partner could. But there are other areas where, you know, partners are going to have further specialization than what we can provide, what we can do. You know, maybe they built up that specialization over years, you know, tackling that problem from the on-prem world, and now they're applying that specialization to the cloud. So we really want partners to fill in the gaps around the things that, you know, we're not natively providing as an AWS security service.
That makes sense. So I'm interested to know more about how people defend their networks, you know, when it comes to the cloud environment, right? So Major General Williams, you know, I know that the Cyberspace Solidarium Commission, which is made up of members of Congress and experts from industry, Tom Fanning, the CEO of Southern Company, a number of folks previously from the government where both you and Eli worked. The Cyberspace Solidarium Commission said that the country needs a change its fundamental social compact around how it defends itself in cyberspace, that it needs to build collective defense between the public sector and the private sector. What does collective defense mean? How does that work in practice? Is it really a realistic thing? And how does it work with the government customer in particular?
Yeah, Jamil, I mean, fundamentally, the United States has always believed in the concept of collective defense. I mean, go to NATO, you know, it's founded on collective defense. And it fundamentally means that, you know, we're going to take the strengths of all the partners within that collective, and we are going to, you know, use my strengths to cover for your vulnerabilities. We're going to use the information that each of us has collectively to defend against common threats. And so absolutely, why wouldn't you apply that to defending yourself in cyberspace? And I think what the Solarium was pointing out is that, you know, we tend to defend one company at a time, right? And there are a lot of concerns and there's a lot of issues about what information do I want to share? There's competitive things, intellectual property, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, exactly, lawyers. So at the end of the day, though, defending each company, each government organization, each entity in a silo is just not effective. You know, for one, we're already at a huge disadvantage against the offenders, right? As a defender, you have to be successful 100 out of 100 times. As an offender, you only got to be successful 1 out of 100 times. As we talked about, the sharing that goes on in the dark web and other places means that the bad guys are working together. And so we have clearly got to get to a collective defense approach if we're going to even get to, I would call, a level playing ground with the attackers. So I think within, you know, business sectors, there are people that have similar goals, they have similar companies, they're located in similar areas. Wouldn't it be great to share information amongst those like-minded people in the same sector to make themselves, you know, stronger in order to defeat that threat? And then importantly, your main point about that and what the commission makes, that collaboration that we're looking for between the public sector and the private sector is about understanding that, just like I saw it at Cyber Command about the time the Iranians were attacking the banks, there was certain information that we had based on our ability to sense the environment that the banks didn't have. At the same time, the banks had a lot of information about the specific threat techniques, et cetera, and there was no good way necessarily to share that. So the government has capabilities they can bring to bear. The private sector has a lot of capabilities. And as we said, they're on the front line. The question is, how do we get everybody to a point where we understand what information is most important to share in order to raise our defenses? And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that is cultural, right? It's this relationship of private sector and public sector. What do we trust? What do we want the government involved with, et cetera, et cetera? But I think more and more people are coming around to the idea that the government brings certain advantages, the private sector has certain advantages and responsibilities. How do we combine the best of those in a way where everybody's comfortable with the sharing? But at the end of the day, it makes us more effective as a nation in defending ourselves against the threats we face.
Yeah. And I want to key up a word you said there. So you talked about sharing, but you also talked about collaboration, right? It's not just about sharing information, right? It's actually about taking action. Isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, at IronNet, you know, we like to talk about an operational approach or an operating concept that we have developed called collective defense. In my view, it has these four components. Number one is visualization, right? You've got to be able to see all the attack surface that you care about. Back to the supply chain discussion. If I'm a large energy company or I'm a defense company or a financial company, there are a lot of other people besides just me that I'm interested in knowing, are they being attacked? And if so, how? So visualization over everything you care about. And if you carry that to the national level, you know, the obligation the nation has to defend its critical infrastructure, we'd like to see what's going on in the energy sector, the financial services sector, telecommunications, water, whatever it is. We want to have visibility over those threats in order to understand how to better defend. So that visualization leads to number two, which is more specific threat sharing. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of bad guys doing a lot of bad things, right? But if I could look across this attack surface at whatever level it was, whether it was a sector, a supply chain, or even a nation, and go, wow, these 5 or 6 things just happened in the last hour. They're all very similar, and they were all targeted at financial institutions in this area. Then instead of defending against everything, I've got some very specific threat intel. No kidding, this is going on right now. Am I vulnerable to it? Yes or no? And that's what allows me to start, you know, being proactive. And the faster you can share that, the more can happen at machine speed, the better you get. Like, we've worked very hard to anonymize the data so that there aren't concerns about competitive information or customer information being shared. It's just the metadata, if you will, about those attacks so that you can analyze it in your own environment. And then number three, then that leads to the collaboration you just said, Jamil. When we're all looking at the same alerts, we're looking at the same metadata, we can look at it in near real time. You know, maybe Eli's company has some very advanced analysts. Your company is a little more junior. It's an opportunity for them to share techniques, for them to share, how do I come to this conclusion about this threat? And it kind of raises all the boats, right? Without adding any more staff, you've raised the expertise for the collective. And then finally, we have to get beyond, and most people recognize this, it's just hard to get there, is our traditional defenses are based on what we refer to as signatures. And fundamentally, that means we saw an attack happen. We look at the IP, the domain, hashes, you know, other things like that. And we create a signature for the attack. And then that goes to some repository somewhere. And then it's distributed to all sorts of devices in all sorts of ways. And that is great that we've gotten that far with things like ISACs, et cetera. But it's really kind of rearward looking. And if you're the first one attacked with that technique, there's no signature that exists for it, right? So the other fourth concept that we think is really important as part of our collective defense and what we apply is the concept of behavioral analytics, because the, you know, most effective threats today aren't done by malware. You know, it's theft of credentials or other access to a network that allows the hacker to use common services, protocols, applications, but they're using them in subtly anomalous ways. And so the ability to identify that those routine activities are occurring, but something about this one is just not quite right. That's what we want to identify with those behavioral analytics. And as Eli alluded to, that's where the buzzwords come in. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, because when you're looking for anomalies in a network that's fundamentally anomalous, you're going to get a lot of false positives. And so it's the AI and machine learning that helps you bubble to the top those events that are most likely to be malicious and things you're concerned about. And then back to the collaboration, the threat sharing, and the visibility. So that's kind of how that concept comes together for us.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So Eli, help me understand how the cloud helps sort of, you know, play out this collective defense approach. Does it help? Is it better? Is it easier? What does the cloud enable when we're talking about collective defense?
I'd say probably the simplest way is that the cloud reduces friction. So, you know, we have at AWS a number of services that are really designed to help share information. So, you know, if you wanted to build collective defense around sharing IOCs, indicators of compromise, you know, something really simple would be setting up a shared S3 bucket. So those that could be shared across your team, even across companies potentially. So we have a lot of the underlying infrastructure that really makes sharing of data easier. And it's also why we see many security companies building their offerings on top of AWS, because it allows them to build sort of the more advanced collective defense capabilities faster and get that value to their customers.
And it allows scale, right? Scale and access to this massive computing power that otherwise you would have to spend tens of millions of dollars to purchase on your own.
Yeah. I mean, so spinning up a fleet of servers to crunch through, you know, terabytes, even petabytes of data can be done in minutes in AWS. Whereas, you know, if you're going to do that, maybe anywhere else besides the NSA, you'd probably be waiting months and months for those servers to be delivered to your data center.
I was just going to pile on to what Eli said. I mean, we have taken tons of advantage of the services that Eli's talked about to design our platform, to make it more efficient, to make it to a real SaaS offering, and to facilitate the sharing for all the reasons he talked about. The security that's built in, the scale, the ability to call resources on demand. And so certainly that's a core part of that collective defense capability.
Gotcha. How does IronNet deliver this collective defense capability in the AWS or hybrid cloud environment? I've got to assume that it must be different than how we do it in on-prem, right? Can you really bring that on-prem capability where you're tapping an entire network pipe to check for threats? Can you really bring that capability to a cloud environment? How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on one side is the ability to host in AWS, which allows us to get customers up and running much more quickly. frankly, lower costs and much more operational friction than it costs to do on-prem. At the same time, some customers still want on-prem. And so we obviously still provide that service, but our preferred is to be able to host in AWS. And at the same time, for all the reasons we've talked about, is the ability to apply those analytics and that collective defense concepts to cloud-based traffic. And there's a number of ways to sense that actual cloud traffic, as Eli talked about. And we have certainly taken advantage of applying our analytics to that traffic in AWS so that we can provide that same type of service in terms of detect anomalies within traffic that's native to the cloud as opposed to on-prem. But the concept remains exactly the same, whether we're talking about traffic that's moving around on the hardware that AWS provides that creates the cloud, or it's your private cloud in your company, or it's your legacy network. At the end of the day, we know that the bad guys are good at altering logs and doing things like that. We want to get as close as we can to that real-time flow data and to be able to look for anomalies and behavior in there that would indicate malicious activity.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess one last question that I really do want to sort of see how this works in practice. So one last question for either of you. How does this sharing of information across multiple companies, across multiple industries, how does that help you identify new and novel threats or identify threats that you wouldn't otherwise have found in your network? How does that work? And why is that a thing?
I would say just quickly, and then I'll let Eli give his perspective. A quick example of that is I might say something in my environment that I would look at and go, that's kind of strange, but I don't know if it's really important, right? But if I'm in this collective defense arrangement and I look in there and I go, based on what we do, we look at literally hundreds of thousands of events every week. And now I can look in there very quickly and I go, here's this thing that kind of came on my radar. I'm not sure if it's anything. Without that collective picture, I might just move on. But with that collective picture, I can see in one graphical interface and go, actually, seven other people saw the same thing in the last 12 hours. Maybe I ought to look at this, right? And now I can look at the metadata. I can look at the actual packet capture flow. I can collaborate with someone else who saw this. And now we're kind of crowdsourcing the analysis of something that we might not even looked at twice had we not known that other people experienced the same thing.
That makes a lot of sense. Any thoughts on that, Eli?
Yeah, I think what I'd add to that, and it's really to amplify what General Williams mentioned, is that most threat detections are an exercise in probability, especially ones that use things like machine learning. There's essentially a probabilistic assumption that you have detected something that is malicious. But, you're never going to be 100% sure that that thing that was malicious, that you think might be malicious, actually was malicious.
Right.
So additional pieces of evidence that can increase your confidence, increase the probability that that thing is indeed malicious is always going to be useful. And using pieces of evidence that other folks, perhaps even other companies have identified as malicious is going to help with that assessment as you're triaging alerts and assessing whether that alert is part of an actual incident or not.
I wanted to add on one more layer though to the AI and machine learning thing, because one aspect of AI machine learning is in the detection phase, like Eli just articulated. The other side is, a day doesn't go by in dark reading or whatever your feed is that doesn't talk about alert fatigue, and all this stuff. And a lot of times the way people deal with alert fatigue is they find a way to close the funnel at the top, right? Well, give me less alerts then, right? I would argue, I would rather know that I'm detecting 100,000 things a day, but the application of AI and machine learning is what allows me to rack and stack or prioritize those 100,000 alerts so that if I can only look at one a day, that I know I'm looking at the one most likely to be malicious, right? If I got a staff that can look at 100, then I can look at 100. But I always get very antsy if I go, well, let's just cut down on the number of alerts we're giving you, because that starts to close the aperture and who knows what you're missing. So there's the AI and machine learning that helps you get better at the detection. And then there's the AI machine learning that helps you get better at the triage and the analysis.
Right. Major Williams, what about this this idea that if I'm a big company and I have a huge SOC and I've got 50, 100 SOC operators, Am I able to leverage that capability to better defend those smaller companies in my supply chain that have only one or two SOC operators? And if so, how does that work?
You know, if I'm that big company with that very capable SOC, then as I look across all the alerts that I'm concerned with, and I've got my supply chain there, you know, we've got the ability to filter that. And so you can be very specific at the segments you look at. But I think step one is I would want to look across my supply chain and see, were there any common behaviors against companies in my supply chain? Regardless of whether they were successful again or not, is not the point. It's who's doing the reconnaissance, who's doing the scanning, who is making those attempts. And now, even if it wasn't successful, having access to that metadata, I am probably going to have at my level the analysts who maybe have some offensive experience from time in the government or those sorts of things. And they may start to put together things that look seemingly innocuous, but with a little different experience and a little different background, you may go, you know, this needs to be looked at a little closer. And now you can coordinate directly with that other company, have a discussion about that, and maybe get a little more information from them that you wouldn't normally have in order to further analyze that. So twofold, that helps me out as the big company because they probably aren't after that small company. They're really probably after me. But number two, I am now positioning that smaller company, that less experienced staff, to be better on their own, right? To better defend themselves in the future, which better defends me.
Now that makes sense. I think it's a great note to end on. Listen, I want to thank AWS and Eli Khan for being here with us today. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for listening. If you would like more information on how Carahsoft, IronNet Cybersecurity, or AWS can assist your federal agency, please visit www.carahsoft.com. Feel free to email us as well at ironnetmarketing@carahsoft.com or awsmarketing@carahsoft.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.